Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler. One of the featured artists in the holiday show at the Cora Logos Gallery in Basalt is painter Terry Gardner. Terry also has some work in next month's Coors Western Art Show at the National Western Stock Show. Katie and K's Clara DeLarbe spoke with Terry about his artistic process.
We're sitting here with painter Terry Gardner, born and raised in Missouri and then called to Colorado to paint the outdoors and develop an intimate relationship with the land and life of the West. Gardner's compositions are born from his surroundings, but evolve in his studio to a place that is darker and deeper, where mystery and contemplation are nurtured. Gardner's work tells the story of the American West, rich yet young in scale and alive with industries and lifestyles that most tend to think of as history. Good morning, Terry. Welcome to KDNK. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to sharing a little bit about the inside of my work.
Wonderful. So what is it about the West and its spirit that has captivated you since childhood?
A family vacation was, I think, instrumental at a young age. We went to Colorado, and I was pretty struck by the open space and the mountains, and it was just something I hadn't seen growing up in Missouri. So I think that was pretty instrumental. And I think another aspect of the West that really intrigued me was Western television and Western movies. I used to watch Gunsmoke with my father. I liked Alias, Smith and Jones, and Jeremiah Johnson was a movie that really kind of captured my interest and spirit of the West. And I think those were, at the time, you don't realize how much of an influence they have on you. But as you grow older, you just realize what you're doing as a child from even an entertainment or media perspective that's beginning to have an influence on your interest. So I think that's a little bit about what captivated my spirit as a young person.
Okay. So over the years that you've been painting, how do you see the boundaries between Western landscapes and human influence changing?
Well, I think that's an excellent question in terms of how it relates to my work, because what's really intriguing about the West is that it is so, there's so many industries and interests that pull at the heart of people in this country. I think it's both about its recreation, it's the outdoors, it's conservation, it's wildlife, it's industries such as mining and wind and gas, and all those are very relevant topics to this day. And then you think about what brought a lot of people to the West, the gold rush and the chance to homestead and have your own piece of land to farm, and the ranching and the cattle and all those industries that may have taken place or brought people westward in the 1800s, they are still very relevant to this day. And I think sometimes they feel like they're often at odds with each other. You can find sometimes that ranchers can be really instrumental in conservation and caring about the land just as much as a conservationist. And a lot of times you're seeing in current events that those industries have to come together to find a common ground so that the industries can potentially survive, but they can also help each other out in preserving land or helping each industry. And I think that's a really interesting aspect about the West. Those industries haven't gone away. They just have evolved.
Right. The evolution of Colorado. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
And it's nice that
everybody is working together to preserve this land that's so precious to us all.
Yeah, and one of the organizations I work with as a guest artist is Ranchlands, who operates multiple ranches in the West, both in Colorado and New Mexico. And they're huge ranches, but they have a vested interest in the future of ranching and making sure that they don't overgraze or really respect the native grasses and the land itself. And that is a intriguing aspect of kind of ranching and where it's going. And I will be involved in a show coming up in 2018 that has a lot to do with the future of ranching. But it has changed a great deal over the past 100 years.
Right. So your paintings depict scenes that feel so familiar to us here in Colorado, from the bristlecone pines to ranchers and cattle meeting in the open plains. And what is it about these characters that inspire you, and what inspires you to choose the subjects of your paintings?
Well, it's I like open space. I like getting out and seeing where there is both the evidence of man, sometimes not so much, but that, as we just discussed, the changing of the West, and certainly the population is growing immensely. I think it's also what influences my subject is not just being void of human presence, but how is it interacting? What's that dance between civilization and nature? And I think ranching is a big part of that, where you have this opportunity to witness brandings or these roundups and watch the cowboys and the cowgirls do a very hard and difficult job, but it's being close to nature at the same time, but witnessing an industry. Whereas when I am intrigued by trees or the bristlecone pines, which is something that's really touches my soul in terms of those trees. They are the oldest living trees on the planet, and most of my subjects for the bristlecone pines come from Bristlecone Scenic Area, which is near Alma, just south of Breckenridge. These trees have survived thousands of years, and the oldest ones are in California. There are ones in Colorado that are dated over 2,000 years old, but they've survived fires and droughts and some very difficult weather implications, but also even miners have taken some of these trees down to build mines. But they have survived, they persist, they are kind of spiritual in nature. So these subjects that I do can be very vast, but they all are part of what I like and am intrigued about is the American West. It's a very diverse land. It's got a lot of stories to tell, and that's what I try to do with my work, is make sure that there's a richer story and there's some aspect that pulls the viewer in and kind of prompts some contemplation about the actual subject depicted.
Right. You really have us thinking about where history meets the modern world, and that they're all still coexisting, of course. So do you paint for collectors or for yourself?
Well, I there's a quote by Oscar Wilde that I have on my studio wall that I think is really important for both the artist and the collector. It's his words are, a true artist takes no notice whatever of the public. The public are to him non-existent. And while that may seem like there's a bit of arrogance to it, it's really important that an artist is about truth to himself and what it is he's trying to say. And if you're a collector, you want to support an artist that's really being true and not chasing the winds of time or any kind of trends. And I really do try to paint for myself. However, never underestimate the importance of collectors and patrons of the arts when it comes to supporting artists so that they can scratch out a living. It is not an easy thing to do. But I really try to stay true to myself and just paint for myself.
Mm. Good. Well, we're so glad that you do.
Thank you.
So some of your landscapes are very much in the style of the French Barbizon painters who lived and worked in the mid-19th century, like Rousseau, Corot, Millet. Yet being an artist in this century has a new set of rules applied to the game. Tell us how you see tools like social media. Do you think social media is a blessing or a curse? And how do galleries play a role in making your art known and appreciated?
Well, the comparison to Corot and Millet, I think, is I'm humbled by that. They're masters and well-respected. And while I am typically looked upon as a representational painter, I often describe myself more in the lines of a tonalist painter because of my palette. But back to that quote about Oscar Wilde and the artist really being true to himself and taking no notice whatever of the public, I think that's what's really important as an artist. And it wasn't easy for me to really come to that resolve that I can't be influenced by certain genres of painting and what's popular. There is some feedback I get and discussions where we see the younger generation looking more to abstract art, and I think it's become a little bit more heightened in its popularity. But I can't chase that if it's not what I really want to do as an artist. I have to be true to myself, and I think it's important when I'm trying to tell a story and make a connection with a viewer or a patron, I have to do what works for me, and what works for me right now is doing work that is representing a place or a space or a subject, and that's super important to me. And I'm not going to kind of veer off that course at this current time. As far as how the tools of social media, you could probably make a case that there are challenges and things that are not good, but there are things that are very good. We can all publish our work and we can get it out there and so forth. I try not to be necessarily influenced by that. Some artists are better than others at using the social media as a tool. There are pros and cons on both sides. And on your final question about galleries are super important. However, they have their challenges as well. The market has certainly changed. We've lost a lot of galleries in the past 10 years because of the online presence of artists and the ability for artists to sell directly or online galleries. But physically seeing the work is still important, making that personal connection. What I love about painting is there's texture and substance that you can see in a work of art that often you can't see online. You can't see a 4-foot by 6-foot painting and experience it the same way online that you can in a gallery. So the physical space is very important, and I hope that as we see the gallery world evolve, there's still many places for collectors to go see the actual work.
Right, it's true that when you're standing in front of these paintings, especially oil paint, to see the brush strokes and the physical texture of the paint, I mean, that's unparalleled, and it certainly can't be replicated digitally. I mean, you know, when you're looking at something on a screen versus in person, it's a whole different experience.
It is, Claire, and I think it's an important aspect. When people have asked me, do you do reproductions or giclées to make your work attainable to those that are either young collectors or those that don't have perhaps the financial means to buy a larger painting, I have refrained at this time because, first off, there's a lot of great work out there, and I do appreciate those that actually buy original work, and I try to just do a painting in itself, and that texture, that substance that you see on the actual canvas, the dripping of the paint, or the it's almost the raised up brush strokes that are visible, are what make paintings more unique now than ever, because we are seeing so much work online and pixels are representing it. But what is the actual art in the end if you're just seeing it on a monitor and then it goes away briefly and then it's in a cloud somewhere for years and years to come? And I think that the using the senses and the touching and seeing and feeling those works of art is super important.
So is that your favorite element of oil painting? Is that why you chose that as a medium? The ability to build up the textures and really feel, make the scene dimensional.
That is a very important aspect of it. But probably it's because I started working in oil at a young age. My father was a commercial artist, and I got a oil paint set. Yeah, one of those paint-by-number sets when I was very, very little. And it was really just kind of this bug that I caught, and it stuck with me. And I always just loved oil paints. I actually love the smell of the oil paints. I love that you're able to work with them longer than, say, an acrylic or watercolor as far as their drying time. And managing the drying time is one of the important elements of producing a piece of work. The summer, hotter temperatures, the paint dries faster, colder temperatures in the winter in the studios, paints seem to dry longer. So you kind of have to manage that. And that's part of what I love, though, is just the extended drying time and the texture and layering of paint and bringing that aspect that we discussed as far as being able to see and feel and giving it some more dimension.
So with this extended drying time, it seems like it would be even more difficult to determine when the work is finished. How do you know when it's done?
Yeah, that's an important piece that any artist would tell you is sometimes a joke, because we always say there's two people that need to do a painting, one to do the actual painting and another person to hit you upside the head when it's done so you don't overwork it. And that is a risk often that artists take with their work, is going too far and being able to step away from it when it just feels right. And I think that that's the answer to the question, is you work it and you take it on this journey and you go with it on this journey, but at some point you just have to feel like this is where I'm happy with it. It's what the vision I had when I started the piece. It's what I'm trying to say, and you step away from it. I learned a great deal reading about de Kooning and how his process was painting and scraping and applying drawings that he worked on over top and all sorts of different kinds of tools. And that is part of the process. Sometimes you put colors next to each other that work, or certain textures, and you pull it back off, and it really is an interaction with your canvas as you develop a piece of work.
So what do you find you're still learning about the process?
Patience. While you can't work on pieces for forever, you do have to be patient, because a piece of work, a painting, it sometimes is like a road trip where you have one day where it's good, or the next day you have bad weather or you veer off course. But you have to just kind of be patient and trust yourself in the process, and be willing to, if it's not going the direction or what your original intentions were, you have to kind of step back or course correct. But it's the process, and being patient is one aspect of it, There's another aspect that it's, I also think is really important is what I call mind noise. This kind of relates to that Oscar Wilde quote about not taking any notice whatever of the public, but the mind noise is something that it doesn't matter what industry you're in, is that you have those thoughts of like, oh, what's someone so going to say about this? Is the are the collectors going to like this? Are gallery owners going to like this? So forth. And it's really just being in that zone where you block out any kind of distractions or noise and really just get into the flow of doing your painting and that process. And the time just goes by so beautifully because you're just really connected.
That's wonderful. So as a self-employed artist, you're not locked into a 9-to-5 kind of a work schedule. So what time of day are you most inspired to paint in the studio and then outdoors?
I am in the studio pretty early in the morning. I have 3 kids. I take them to school because of my flexible schedule. So right after I take them to school, I get into the studio. It's also the best time for lighting. Natural light is important. I do a lot of color mixing and really want to check those values and the temperatures of those colors as I'm putting them on the canvas. So having good natural light is important. And when we get to this time of year, really working from like 8 to 3 is probably the best time. It starts getting dark fairly early, so you start losing that light late afternoon. You have more of a work time, longer studio time in the summer. But I definitely work during the day when I have good natural light. And when it comes to the outdoor work, it's when I get on those little 3-4 day journeys and have a chance to get away and go experience a new location in the mountains or out on the plains or visit one of the ranches down in near Pueblo or near the sand dunes. It's again during the day, but those little times when you can get away and experience subjects firsthand are invaluable.
And what is your favorite way to capture the scene when you are outdoors on these trips?
I used to do a lot of fine air painting. However, now I've evolved to where I use drawing materials, and I do a lot of sketching, which is an important part of the process in doing painting. The plein air work, I felt sometimes like I was rushed to do this painting and you only have a window of time, whereas I just wanted to kind of have the chance with drawing to see and experience the surroundings and do more looking and feeling of what the subjects are. And that's what I do now. And I also, photography is an important part of it. However, when I get back to the studio, it's the combination of looking at the photos, looking at the drawings, and then evolving the process where I mix colors and start developing what that palette's going to be. And there's a lot of work that's done before you actually put paint to canvas.
So you don't just sit there and make the magic happen. It's nice that there's such a process, and it's all by your hand, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and charcoal, whether I'm using charcoal on location or doing further drawings in the studio with charcoal, I draw it out. I can use blending sticks and erasers and kind of move the charcoal around a little bit. And sometimes you mess them up and you throw them away and then you do another one. And then it's like you captured what you were looking for, that ethereal quality in the scene. And that's the point where you feel like, all right, I'm ready to take this to color and develop this into a larger piece.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you have coming out. Terry, thank you so much for your time today. We look forward to seeing your work at the Coors Western Art Exhibit and Sale in Denver, as well as the artist reception and opening of Winter in the West at Ancor Logos Gallery in Basalt.
Thank you, Claire. I really appreciate your time, and thanks to all your listeners.
The show at the Cora Logos Gallery in Basalt, called Home for the Holidays, Small Works, Big Statements, hangs until January 6th. You can get more information at coralogosgallery.com. Stay with me, John McEwen, up next on today's Express Yourself.
Looking out the window of this Hollywood hotel, you'd never know that it was Christmas Eve. The billboards and the neon took the place of silver bells, and the temperature is 84 degrees. I can hear the traffic on the crowded strip below as the palm trees poke their heads above the scene. But there's not a single reindeer and it hardly ever snows, and Santa drives a Rolls Royce limousine. But all along the Rockies you can feel it in the air, tell you right to Boulder down below. The closest thing to heaven on this planet anywhere is a quiet Christmas morning in the Colorado snow. Is when I was just a boy. In the morning I would run to see the tree, and the carolers on the hillside sang their songs of Christmas joy. Well, I always thought they sang them just for me. Now the sun is setting in the California sky, I can't find the spirit anywhere. So I think it's time for me to tell Los Angeles goodbye. I'm going back home to look for Christmas there. But all along the Rockies, you can feel it in the air, from Telluride to Boulder down below. Morning in the Colorado snow. It's a quiet Christmas morning in the Colorado snow.
Well, that's the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band playing a John Hartford tune revered around these parts. One of the founding members of that seminal band, John McEwen, visited the Holy Bozos show on KD&K last January, right before a very special gig at the Wheeler Opera House commemorating the Will the Circle Be Unbroken recording sessions. John told a few stories and played a few tunes from his 2016 CD Made in Brooklyn. John McEwen returns to the area with another show a week from tomorrow night at the Youth Theater in Rifle. The show is built around video archives of the Unbroken sessions. Here is John live on KD&K almost a year ago.
When the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band started in 1966, we didn't get on the road until we had our first radio record in 67, February 7. And I was the only one. I was 21, I was the oldest, the only one old enough to rent a car. So I became road manager, too. And it was quite a enduring. I did that for 10 years till I found a word in the dictionary that said delegate. And delegated it to another person. And yeah, so here we are in Carbondale.
And what brings you in? What do we have going on?
Well, I got
today?
Matt Cartsonis here with me. And
that's
he's,
me.
And he spent a lot of time on stage with me over the last 25 years. When I get away from Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, it's with him.
Hi.
And that happened to be last year. We did an album together. I put together an album in Brooklyn that was recorded around one microphone, one binaural microphone, where you gathered everybody around, and that included David Bromberg, John Carter Cash, Steve Martin,
Martha Redbone.
Martha Redbone, John Cowan, the great singer from Newgrass Revival. He's now out with the Doobie Brothers. Jay Unger, the great fiddle player.
Molly Mason.
Molly Mason, his wife, sang backgrounds.
Marilyn McEwen.
My wife even. You want to say something, Terry? Go ahead.
Well, you had an elder gentleman with you on this, too.
David Bromberg or David Amram?
No, the
David Amram.
Guy.
He's that 80
David
something.
Amram is 86 years old.
Yeah.
His music was conducted by Leonard Bernstein at Carnegie Hall. And back in the 60s, he was a composer in residence. He did the score for The Manchurian Candidate. David and I, he calls me Pops. And he's played with me probably, I don't know, 50 times over the years. And this was my dream list of people I've wanted to record with. In all this travels with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, I'd end up meeting people and sitting in with them or playing with them, but not recording with them. And so they came together. And we did most of the songs in one take because of the way it was set up. And let's give people a taste of that.
Well, you left out that extra banjo player.
Yeah, well, Steve Martin plays on one of the cuts, too. It's that was a nice thing to call him. The first time he was ever called just as a musician.
Yeah, and didn't you help get him started in banjo?
Steve says that I introduced him to the banjo and taught him how to play, but he took off on his own pretty quick.
And then She Dark the Sun, did you want to say anything about that?
That song is one of the reasons I wanted to make an album. There's a bunch of tunes I wanted to record that, you know, you just can't do it within a band situation. Say, I've got 15 songs I want to put on the next album. And She Dark the Sun is one that I've only heard two people that could really sing it. One was Jimmy Ibbotson and one is John Cowan. And I told Cowan I wanted him to sing this Bernie Ledden song that Bernie and Gene Clark wrote before the Eagles came together. And I think this is a classic hippie country rock song of the early 70s, late 60s that it's only been done right once, I think, prior to this. That was Linda Ronstadt's version.
And a name that means a lot to me as a listener, Gene Clark, an overlooked songwriter, and
yes,
some great work he did. In fact, didn't he play with the Dillards? And they were one of
Dillard, Clark, and Hillman.
Yeah.
And he played with Doug Dillard.
Okay. And we'll talk about the Dillards later, but right now we've got this queued up, and should we let it roll?
It was so exciting to have 14 people around this one microphone and watching him sing this song in the key of G.
Oh, boy.
And with the length of her mind, she darked the sun. It was not so long ago, maybe just a year or so, when I was lonely and when looking for someone. Way down south in New Orleans, just a looking for a dream, that's when I found her, that's where it all begun. She was there on that night. Dark. Well, my memory cannot speak, and oh Lord, I'm feeling weak, but I lean on the fact that I was young. Though I know it may sound strange, there is no way I can change what my fate is laid out for.
That from Roots Music, Made in Brooklyn.
Yep.
And John, anything more you want to say about this? Because we're going to also cover tonight, because that's...
Well, tonight's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, tonight I've got the show. I've been doing a lot of multimedia shows using film behind us while we're on stage, talking about both the early Dirt Band and how it led to the fifth album, Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy, that finally had a hit record. Mr. Bojangles, Some of Shelley's Blues, and House at Pooh Corner were on that album. And that leads into the fact that the Dirt Band was the first American group to go to Russia. And as that footage plays behind us, we're on stage playing the music that accompanies that and talking about what's on the screen. And Jan Garrett went to the Soviet Union with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, the first American group to go there. And we wanted to take her because we didn't want to just represent our viewpoint of American music and needed to take a female singer. And that was really cool. She did a killer job. And she's coming by tonight. And Bobby Mason is going to be the opening act and a participant later on in the show. And Bobby, I met him in 1972. I was watching him in an opera ski thing. And he ended up being probably one of the only guys I've ever paid to see sing. He's one of my favorite singers and people. Jimmy and I are, you know, that poor guy, he had to sit. When we were rehearsing for the Uncle Charlie album, we did 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And Jimmy and I would drive down from Hollywood, and I'd be in the back seat of his Dodge Dart learning how to play the fiddle, like 1 foot from his head. That's what I say that poor guy for. And he put up with it. He was very encouraging. Jimmy Ebbins is one of the most important people in my musical life.
And that started 60s, early 70s.
Jimmy was Les Thompson, an original Dirt Band member. He played for the first 8 years. He'll be there tonight. John Cable, who also played with us in the 70s when we went to Russia, will be there tonight. And Les and I started the band in the 60s, along with the Jeff Hanna and Jimmy Fadden. But in 68, we broke up after Paint Your Wagon. 69, we went and found Jimmy Ibbotson. He could play the drums and sing and play guitar and everything. That's kind of when the Dirt Band started. He brought his energy, songwriting, playing abilities, and a certain side of zany that when you could capture it, was something nobody else had. And
And the idea for the circle, and then the
circle. What do you mean?
Will the circle be unbroken? And all those guys and gals, maybe, that you reached out to.
Well, what happened there is we made this Uncle Charlie and his dog Teddy album, and it was getting a lot of airplay. And the sons of Earl Scruggs, Jimmy Martin, different people, and Maybelle Carter's relatives, they heard the album and they played it for their parents. And in 1971, I went to Tulagi's in Boulder to ask Earl Scruggs if he'd record with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And he was familiar of us because he said, "That Randy Lynn rag, that's always the way I wanted to play that song." One of his songs I put on the album. I couldn't have ever had a better compliment. Actually, he said, "That's the way I intended to play that." I said, "That's too kind, Earl." But he said yes. And a week later, Doc Watson was at the same club. And I told him, "Earl's in. Would you join us?" And he said yes. Then my brother called. He was managing us and living in Aspen at the time. Most of the band was living in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I'm going to get Merle Travis." And Merle Travis, you familiar with him? Merle Travis invented a style of guitar playing that, it's kind of like, crank that up. It's, he'd be able to play the thumb part, the bass, and a little melody. And here's a song he wanted to record on the album. I'll see if I can do a version of it. It's Cannonball Rag. And it goes like this.
Gentlemen, we have John McEwen and Matt
Carsonis.
Thank you for being with us here today. Big
glad
show
to be here, Terry.
Thank you. Big show tonight, and it's fantastic to have you guys come into our community station. And I wonder if you would say a little bit about radio, because you talked about radio on the road, and maybe what radio you listened to when you were young, and then you have a radio. Like a phenomenon going on, don't
phenomenon?
You?
Phenomenon?
On Sirius, isn't that?
Well, I've had a radio show for 8 years on Sirius XM called Acoustic Traveler. It's in its eighth year now, and it's an hour-long show. They play it seven times a month when I turn one in, and I use music from all the people I've met over the years and have relationships with, and or even not, because sometimes you sit in with somebody and you don't really know them. You know, you don't see them again. Like Tom Petty, for instance. We were recording Will the Circle Be Unbroken Volume 3 doing Willie Nelson in Hollywood. And that's the one I called Dave Jackson to play the bass on.
I was there.
Oh, that's right, you were. And we're getting ready to record Goodnight Irene, and I saw that Tom Petty was recording down the hall. I don't know Tom Petty, but I waited for his mix to stop, and I went in, "Hi, Mr. Petty, I'm curious. I'm with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and wondered if you'd ever wanted to sing with Willie Nelson." And it really shocked him. He went, "Well, yeah, but how do I?" "Well, come down the hall. We need you to sing a verse of Goodnight Irene and find a harmony part." And 5 minutes later, we're recording with Tom Petty. I haven't seen him since, nor before. But I'll play that cut on my Sirius show and tell that story.
And there are so many people that you have played with over this 50-some years.
Yeah.
And a couple that I just made notes that I'm curious about.
Yeah.
Bill Wyman. Say anything about that event?
Yeah. When we were rehearsing the early Dirt Band back in the 66, where our first important job was opening for Merle Travis at the Ash Grove, which is now the Improv. But we were playing music like Washington at Valley Forge, freezing cold and up spoke George, Vododio, Vododio Do. Crazy words, crazy tune, all the George could croon and swoon was Vododio, Vododio Do. Vododio. Jug band music. You know, we had no hope of getting a record deal. Billboard magazine saw us and did a review that said, entertaining, but doubtful if they'll ever be captured on record. Now, during that rehearsal, in walked a guy asking if we wanted to be on Liberty Records. And we said, well, we just signed a deal with Liberty Records. Well, mind if I listen? That was Leon Russell. Leon Russell and I started a friendship then that ended up crossing paths many times. I probably sat in with him 20 times at least. I recorded at his house in Tulsa and Nashville. And one time in the middle of the 70s, I get this call, and the band's hanging out in the hotel room. I think Ibby was there. And Jeff answers and goes, yeah, he's here. Sure, I'll put him on. He looks at me and says, Leon Russell's on the phone. I said, oh, good, I haven't talked to him in a year. Oh, hi, Leon, how you doing? And it shocked the other guys in the band, you know. And I said, well, sure, Jeff. And I'm talking to Leon, and he says, would you like to talk to us? And I had to ask Jeff. I said, who's Bill Wyman? He said, well, he plays bass in the Stones. Why? Okay, just wondered. Yeah, Leon, put him on. Oh, hi, Mr. Wyman. Nice to meet you. He wanted me to record on his Monkey Grip album, which was the first Bill Wyman solo album. And 2 days later, I'm out there in Hollywood playing dobro, mandolin, and banjo for Rolling Stone. It was a fun day. And Leon, when I showed up there, Leon was such a humble guy. Oh, John, I'm glad you're here. I've already played my three licks, and we need some more. I don't do good hanging out with these stars. And he was playing that night at the Forum, headlining a sold-out show. he was, and saying he didn't hang well with the stars.
And then there was purportedly an earthquake in Southern California.
Purportedly? it shook the crap out of the place, yeah.
And then did that have any effect on you coming to this area? Is that
one month later, maybe less than a month, I'd packed up everything in a Ryder truck, moved to Colorado with my wife and our first kid that was about 9 months old. I gave her $500 in Denver. I said, turn in the truck, find a house, buy a car. I'll be back in 10 days. But that was the way it was. The Dirt Band had to get to New York to do the Tonight Show. I came back 10 days later and she'd bought a house and, I mean, not bought a house, rented a house and bought a $300 car and got all the stuff moved in. That was a mess.
And going back, that process of the sessions for Will the Circle Be Unbroken and gathering everybody together, three records you made.
Well, I asked Earl Scruggs that week of June if he'd record with us. He said yes. 8 weeks later, thanks to Earl and Louise Scruggs, we'd gotten Maybelle Carter lined up, Jimmy Martin, which was interesting because Jeff Hanna said, who's Jimmy Martin? I said, you'll find out. He's the greatest bluegrass singer ever, and he'll tell you that. Jimmy Martin had a gravestone he made about 8 years before he died, a big, tall monument. Here lies the king of bluegrass. Want to come out and see my gravestone? You know, he was a weird guy, a fun guy, and he was right. Of course, he thought everybody had a right to his opinion. But Jimmy Martin knew what it was right. And we got together in the studio. We rehearsed the week before, and for 6 days, we recorded 34 songs. And the album, the 34-track album, was done. And it wasn't even full days because most of it was first take. We were recording directly to two-track with a bunch of microphones. And we knew that Maybelle Carter was going to have one really good take. And she knew her song. It was up to us to know it. And Ibbotson and all the guys got together and were ready. And we were scared, you know. I was the oldest. I was 24. I think Les was 20 when we did this album. But the first day, it kind of got okay because we heard from so many of these people that they were fans of each other. Oh, Roy, I've always wanted to record with you. I don't know what's taking so long. I'm glad we're here together, Maybelle. You know, everybody knew each other and liked each other. And we were just the periphery. And it worked out.
But you initiated it.
I did by asking Earl and Doc and my brother putting Merle in it. But it was only possible because I had Jimmy and Jeff picking the right songs to get on the radio and singing them like the Everly Brothers. They were magic together. And the recordings of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band gave that door a possibility to open. If I would have just been that kid from Orange County with a banjo, it wouldn't have happened.
And did you have a sense during the sessions and after you heard playback of the magnitude of what you were involved in?
To me, I did. And to my brother Bill, who was producing, yeah, we felt like this was important to us. It was very important to me to be playing on a recording with Jimmy Martin. I'd spent a couple of years learning every song he'd recorded, you know, and now I'm playing with him. I never thought I'd even meet the guy. But as far as its overall importance, we felt like this sounds really good. Mix Magazine did a 7-page story on how good this album sounded because it was recorded direct to the master. But the overall importance, you just never know. We didn't know. We just thought it was really important. Then Rolling Stone said, possibly the most important record to come out of Nashville. Thank you, Chet Flippo. And it just went on. It's a multi-platinum album. It's in the Library of Congress. Right now, if you look up on Amazon in the Bluegrass chart, it's probably number 14. It's like the dark side of the moon of bluegrass. And it was a record of an event in the sense that a record used to be that. When the Carter family recorded for Pier in Bristol in 1927, that was a capturing of an event of them being in front of one microphone. And that's what this was kind of like for this group. Three different generations.
And quite a few, what do we call them? String wizards. And
yes.
Acoustic travelers from generations. And since you've, it seems like, kind of been with the group and out on your own. And then this collaboration that includes multimedia.
Tonight's show at the Wheeler, yes.
And your... some of your old friends from this area. You have a strong connection here. And didn't your brother live here?
My brother lived here. I made a couple of albums here. The Dirt Band recorded here. Rippling Waters was mixed. And a lot of Dirt Band music was recorded up here in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And let's see, his studio, he did a John Denver special. A couple of film scores were recorded up there and mixed. And really good times. Back when they used to say, let's do a benefit to keep the traffic light from being put in, or save the season pass for the local, you know, things that were really important.
And in that light, I know there might be some more tunes to...
Well, Matt spent the last 6 years of Warren Zevon's life being his backup guy, our co-partner on stage. And Warren wrote a song that...
he wrote this for us to play together.
Okay, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for tuning in. Once again, that show that John is referring to is not tonight. It is next Saturday, a week from tomorrow night at the Youth Theater. You can get tickets and information at youththeater.com. Hey, thank you for listening. Merry Christmas to you and yours. Stay tuned for the news coming right up. And please remember to go out there and express yourself.